Nation Highway yet again today, and I see our panelists are so anxious to present to us. They're already present forward. We're going to have a very, very invigorating discussion about the Quality Education Model, also known as QEM. And that was just kind of a brief segue to the House Education Fund, which we do have seed money there, and we will be supplementing for the use of Ackermans and or ringing cell phones. So, gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
And take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for the Department of Education. We really appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee this afternoon to talk about the Quality Education Commission and the Quality Education Model. And Madam Chair, we will probably at times refer to those as the QEC for Commission and the QEM for the Quality Education Model. You have set a very high standard, Madam Chair, and we are working very hard to meet your standard, and it's a very good thing to do because educators can get lost in jargon sometimes. What I would like to do is very briefly give the committee a little bit of historical overview and a basic understanding of what the model is. The current chair of the Quality Education Commission is Ken Thrasher, who is with us this morning. We'll be talking about the current work of the commission, and my colleague Brian Reeder from the Department of Education will talk about some of the calculations and how the model comes together. So let me just very briefly take the committee back to 1995-96, and at that point the Oregon legislature made a significant change in the manner in which we looked at education in the state. It actually started somewhat in 1991 with the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century, but by the 1995 session, the legislature directed the department to create a set of academic content standards and a set of specific measures of those standards, and then set the expectation that all students would achieve those standards. So the obvious question is, how do you finance a system that has that goal of 100% proficiency as a target? And as I've explained before in some earlier comments, the fundamental shift there is whether or not you're looking at inputs into a model, what do you put into the system, versus what comes out of the system. And at that point, the analysis shifted to what's coming out. What are students learning? How do we know they're learning it? What measures do we have? And are all students making progress? Governor Kitzhaber at the time created a governor's committee on education finance to look at a basic question. What would the system of education look like that would achieve that goal of proficiency for all, and what would it cost? That small committee met for about a year, and one of the recommendations of that committee was to create an in-depth analysis of this entire question. That recommendation was accepted by the governor, and the Legislative Council on the Quality Education Model was impaneled in 1997 by the governor. Then Speaker of the House Lynn Lundquist was made chair of that committee, and the council was composed of members of the House and Senate, as well as educators, business leaders, and members of the Department of Education. The council met for 2 years, beginning in 1997, and in 1999 published its first report. This is a rather rare document. This is my only copy. You'd be hard-pressed to find these. This is the original report of the Quality Education Model from the Legislative Council. And in this was defined for the first time something called the Quality Education Model, or the QEM. Following the publication of this report in 1997, the Legislative Council continued to meet, but one of their recommendations was that this become ongoing work of the state, of the legislature. The governor subsequently created the Quality Education Commission, and that commission is charged, you'll hear more about this later, with preparing a biennial report for the legislature that looks at what are the factors that lead to the educational goals, what do those factors cost, and what recommendations would the commission have for the legislature. It is that report, the most recent one, the 2004 report, that was just published, and the members of the committee have a copy of the report. So just now, very briefly, one note or two about the model. Yes, Madam Chair.
I wrote down two start dates, 1999 and then 1997. Dr. Burke, which when the first report, when was it issued, 97?
The first report, this report was published in June of 1999, but this is the report of the Legislative Council. Yes. This predates the commission, and it was subsequent to this report that the governor established the commission, and there have been now three reports, I believe, two reports, official reports from the commission itself.
Chair Flores, just really quickly, there was some conflicting dates. You said that in 1997 was when the actual group met for 2 years, and then their findings were published in 1999.
That's correct.
Okay. Just for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions or clarifications as we move forward? Thank you.
Then very briefly, to understand the model, there are really two or three key concepts. I don't want to take up too much time. Remember, the basic question is, what would a system of education look like that met the state's goal of proficiency for all students? The way the model works is dependent upon an understanding of assumptions and prototypes. The way the model works is the panel spent 2 years looking at research on best practices of what went into a quality school. For example, class size was one of the issues. Degree of professional development of faculty was another issue. The nature of the curriculum and instructional program was another issue. There was a considerable amount of research on assumptions. Those assumptions then were analyzed using Oregon data drawn directly from Oregon schools through the database initiative. So, for example, a key assumption would be, what's the average teacher salary if you're going to be building a model? Well, rather than make that up, we used DBI data, the database initiative data, Madam Chair, I apologize, the database initiative data to look at, well, what is the actual average teacher salary? And to look at things like that related to elementary, middle, and high school. The length of the school day, whether or not a school had an after-school program, and so on. What does the research indicate as descriptors of quality schools, and what do those elements cost in Oregon? Then the model creates a prototype. That's the other key idea. An elementary, middle, and high school prototype based upon putting all of those elements together around an average school. And then that financial model is applied to that prototype, and the total is then divided by the number of students in the prototype, and what that generates is a per pupil allocation or per pupil cost factor based upon the assumptions and the prototype. Then that per student cost factor is calculated against the total student population, and that's the number that everyone talks about. That's the total number of how you would calculate the application of the assumptions and extrapolate it out to a cost for the state. So my final comment, Madam Chair, before we move on, is that we'd like to emphasize that it is that process of analysis and not that bottom line number where the power of this model lies. It gives you as policymakers and superintendents and the State Department of Education an ability to analyze costs based on factors that the research say contribute to quality schools and using the information based upon actual Oregon data. So I'll give one final example. A key policy question that has been debated both last session and this session is whether or not to go from a half-day kindergarten to a full-day kindergarten. What the model lets you do is look at what the current allocation would be based upon the half-day model and a way to look at how that would be impacted if you moved to an all-day model. And it is that ability to look at different elements and look at how changing those elements produce changes in overall cost. That, we believe, is the real power of the model, not what that overall bottom line number is. So I'll stop there, Madam Chair, and we're prepared to turn it over to Mr. Thrasher unless there are some additional questions.
I have a question. I believe Representative Dolan has a question. Go ahead.
Just this sort of exercise, in the review of the literature, have other states done or accomplished a similar model in pricing education?
Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, what we have seen is that states around the United States have taken a variety of approaches. There are other models that are called standards-based finance models. There are a number of professors around the country who write on this topic. So one answer is yes, we have seen examples from other states. However, I would say that I have not yet seen a model that I would call a replication of this model. And the power of this model is that it is tied directly to costs that are reported in Oregon schools. That specificity appears to be somewhat unique to this model. In other words, many of the other models are more theoretical in nature. The power of the quality education model is that it uses the database initiative data.
The database initiative, that system is used in other states, isn't it?
Other states collect similar information, yes. Most states have a chart of accounts, for example, in their school finance system.
And in theory, all schools report similar spendings in the same categories. And so we do have database initiative in other states, and we do have other models. Do you have any of those other models that I might look at?
I don't have them with me, but I'd be happy to give you some of the other models.
I'd like to look at some of them.
And thank you very quickly. To use your last example of the all-day kindergarten versus half-day kindergarten current policy discussion.
Correct.
As you factor in for that assumption, to see what that bottom line might be. Now, do you include the capital cost in that model?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, that is one of the interesting uses of the model. It not only would look at capital costs, how many classrooms would you need if you went to that model, but it also would let you ask additional questions such as, if I adjusted the class size. That's what I mean by understanding the assumptions behind the model. The model is based on a class size of 40, for example, in kindergarten, on a half-day model. So you could adjust not only half-day to full-day, but you can also think of it in terms of changing class size. And then you can also look at what are the capital implications if I go from one classroom to needing two classrooms if I move from a half-day program to a full-day program. It's that kind of thinking that the model allows you to do.
Point of clarification. Madam Chairman, let me do this appropriately according to protocol. Madam Chairman, may I ask a question?
Please.
I get a little excited. Did that number 40 just come out, or is that the number in the model?
Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, that was the original model based upon the average class size in kindergarten at the time the model was created. When you look around the state, and many kindergarten classes in the state were based on a class size of 40.
Madam Chair, point of clarification, class size, 40 kindergartners starting or 40 in a room with one teacher?
Madam Chair, 40 kindergarten students in a room with a teacher. If you look at how many schools calculate FTE, again, this is part of the assumption in the model. How does a school calculate FTE? The assumption in the model is that FTE would be calculated on a 1 to 40 basis. And the assumption is that 40 kindergarten students would generate one FTE and that that would be a half-day program.
And another point of clarification, because that 40 a kindergarten student counts as one half. So what we're talking about is a teacher with 20 students in the morning, 20 in the afternoon.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, that's correct. So what the model then lets you do is think, if that's the model for a half day, what would it cost and what would be the staffing implications to move that model to full day? What are the implications for class size, for faculty, and for capital costs?
My concern, Madam Chairman, was that we would come away with the opinion that we had kindergarten classes with 40 students in front of one teacher, and it was very important to me that we clear that up, that that means 20 students, which is still rather large, in my opinion, but 40 is, we just cannot leave that impression in the room.
Thank you, Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair, I think as I've looked at the model over a number of years, I mean, there are a whole lot of assumptions that would be good for people to know about when they start setting it up. Example would be high school, in the original model I looked at, was 750 to 800 was the average, the best size. And many of those numbers and assumptions came from best practices as people went and looked all around at the research and said, what is the best practice with respect to size of a school, elementary, middle school, and high school? What is the best practices out there, not just in Oregon, but out there? And then after all of those decisions were made as to what is the best practice as we know it today, those numbers were put into the model. And then we went and looked at Oregon for the amount we spent on each child, put it in there with that model, and came out with a number, i.e. the $7 million. So I think that you really have to understand that this is a very complex mathematical model that has a whole lot of assumptions in it, including class size at each different level, experience of teachers. There's many, many parts to this model. That each one of them, like the deal with the kindergarten, is one that was thought about for a long time, looked at best practices, and then put into the model. All of those can be adjusted and then come out with other numbers, as I understand it.
That is correct. Madam Chair, Representative Roland, you correctly described the model. It is precisely that basic question that I started with, which is what would a system look like that met the state's objectives for all students being proficient? So starting with best practices, looking at the two key concepts are assumptions in the model and prototypes. So look at the research. What are those assumptions? Build a prototypical model, and in doing so, give policymakers such as yourselves an ability to ask questions about school finance. It really is not designed to come up with a bottom line number that we all gather around and agree on. It's more a process of analysis and understanding the implications of policy and how they impact school finance.
And if I just might sum that up, then the ideal would be where we are.
That would be great.
I did want to get further clarification on the capital construction cost component, because I didn't see it in the in the back of the booklet that you handed us. Mr. Reeder?
Chair Flores, Pat is correct in saying that the model will tell us if we go, for example, to full-day kindergarten from the current practice of half-day, that the model will tell us how many additional classrooms we would need. The model as it currently exists, though, does not deal with the issue of capital spending or capital costs themselves. And the reason that is a great many districts in Oregon have excess capacity right now, and they would really have no additional capital costs if they were to add classrooms or add new sections of kindergarten or any other grade. Other districts in Oregon that are growing rapidly don't have excess capacity and really would require some capital investment. So we, over the last session of the commission, have explored an addition to the quality education model, which would be a component to deal with capital spending, but as yet we have not incorporated that into the main part of the model. So at this point, the estimates that come out of the model are strictly operating cost estimates. We are continuing to work on the capital side, though, to put a meaningful capital model in there as a component.
Thank you, and I think I would be remiss in not reminding you to please give us your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Brian Reeder with Department of Education.
Thank you. And thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Press. Chair Flores, committee members, my name is Ken Thrasher. I'm the chair of the Quality Ed Commission. And what I'd like to do is, if we could just take a few minutes, I'll take you through this presentation because I think it kind of summarizes the work of the commission. But I always like to start these out with kind of the end in mind. I always believe that you start with the objective, and that is set in statute here on this first page on trying to get to academic excellence and getting our students to standard. And if you go to the second page, I think the reality is, if we see what's happening in reading and math scores, I think there's three things about this chart that are, these two charts on this page that are important. One is the slope of change, the fact that we're seeing a flattening and even decreasing in our outcome scores that are coming out of 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th grade scores. The impact that of students as they go through the system, i.e., the fact that 3rd and 5th graders were seeing an increase, but we're starting to see a widening of the gap with middle school and high school students, which is an early indicator we've got some real issues to deal with in those two groups. And then third, buried inside these numbers are a couple of things, the achievement gap and the fact that dropouts are not included. And if they were imposed on this, would have a further decrease effect in the 5 to 10% range. So we always have to keep that as a reality when we're looking at numbers. When we look at the achievement gap on the next, if you look at the next two graphs on page 3, this graph was actually prepared to show the impact of No Child Left Behind because the requirement there is 99% of students being at standard. And so if you look at the slope of the curves that are required to do that, I think you very quickly get a picture of what middle schools and high schools have in front of them for us to achieve that kind of change, in addition to reducing dropout rates and other factors. And so I think that is a part of process, efficiency, and funding as we talk through the model and try to figure out how to establish an approach to deal with this challenge. The next two slides on page 4 are the challenges of the achievement gap. This is a very concerning graph because it does show the impact of the demographics, poverty, special needs, ESL students that we have in the system today, and the challenges we're having, especially as we see poverty rates increasing across the state, and probably saw the Oregonian article a week ago that showed an increase of anywhere between 6 and 11%, depending on where you're living, in children in poverty. That's a real challenge for us because of the significant increase of children that we have are in these risk categories. And so the base that we have that we're dealing with is having more challenges to deal with. And that shows up very clearly here that we aren't meeting that challenge. So what is on the next page? What is the role of the commission? This is about, Representative Roebling, you said, it is about continuous improvement, starting at a point in time and not just staying there, but each 2 years looking at the best practices that are going on nationally and trying to bring those into focus in the model and determine what those practices mean in both outcomes and costs based on our current cost structure and on the practices that are put in to help you make decisions around policy making. And that it's also to allow you to identify key policy issues related to accountability, efficiency, and adequacy, which I think are the key three things that we're trying to focus on in the model. And this year, we took somewhat of a different approach. We stepped back and said, not only do we look at K-12, we should start as a state to really look at an integrated approach, because the challenge is the accountability from pre-K to K-12, from middle schools to high school to community colleges and four-year colleges, we're having so much intervention costs and other issues. If we don't look at this as a continuum and deal with strategies in that manner, we are not going to maximize both the efficiency of the system and the effectiveness of what we're trying to produce in students. So we really believe that the approach that we've taken focuses on this pre-K to 20 strategy. Some schools have done that, and they've seen significant improvements in their results as they've integrated, especially from high schools to community and four-year colleges, a number of practices that allowed them to move students faster and at a greater pace through to those institutions. We also need to estimate the funding requirements of these policy changes so that when you make decisions as a state, that we know the impact that's going to have financially and the outcome effect. And then determine the No Child Left Behind requirements. Now, I'll make a comment here. If you look at kind of the average, the model today is about a 68% achievement. If you took all the pieces on average, we're about 68%. If you took the model as it's stated, we achieve about a 92% level with the financials at $7.1 billion. To get to 99%, that last 7% is going to be the most difficult, most costly, most at-risk group of students. We have not finished that work. We could try to just create a simulation for you. We didn't feel that was the right approach in this session to try to come in here with a number that was made up. We're doing research on what that group of students is, what it will take in both practice and dollars to get that group there. So when you look at the model, you must first recognize that the outcome here is 92%. It's not at 99% in the full model. So we focus on accountability, governance, efficiency, and adequacy in the approach that we took. And our first item that we feel is important is integrating the data systems for pre-K to 20. We need to have the ability to track students through the system, know where services need to be brought in, where that connectivity is between the institutions, connect universities, credits, AP programs with high schools, and make it a streamlined process. We are not doing that effectively. And that data system tracks the assessment pieces. The database initiative tracks costs and demographic changes, which we need to forecast because our demographics are having significant change today as we've seen the increase in the number of minority students in our education system. We need to take that and look at the combined governance process that takes that accountability and turns that into actions in the classroom that affect performance. And then that includes the development of a personal education plan for each student that we trace them, track them through the system, and again, know where those resources come to play. That will allow us to really, I think, start to focus on closing the achievement gap and lowering the dropout rate, which is still in the 15 to 20% level today.
Question, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
So when you're talking about developing a personal education plan for each student, do you mean every student in the class or the students who aren't meeting the requirements of the NOTEL level?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we're talking about every student would be on the system to a point where you can see the data, understand what those issues are, and you need a security access so parents can look at that data as well. They need access to scores and understanding where their child is in the process. So it is all students. It's not just students that aren't standard.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as I understand it, the ultimate goal is to almost become real time so that teachers could go in and plug in scores and teachers could see it that afternoon.
Madam Chair, that's correct, and parents as well.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the key is not the percentage of minority students, but the percentage of students with different backgrounds, cultural and others, because I note I have a high percentage of Asian American in my district, and if I look under the math achieving in 8th and 10th grade, they're superior to the rest of the group there. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Barnes, that's correct. One of the challenges we have is our educational teacher force is about 5% culturally, socially minority based. Our student base is approaching or approximately 20%. There is a real issue there today in our learning and our system in dealing with those issues, which is one of the issues we need to deal with in the training and education of teachers. And getting more diversity into the workplace.
Cultural competency. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
One question.
Representative Lin.
I have a simple question. Pre-K to 20 means, are you talking about the age? Are you talking about the total length of time of education?
Madam Chair, Representative Lin, that is education. So that is year 20 of education. So it's through the college system.
So from pre-K?
Yes.
Okay. How many pre-K years? 2 years?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, that would be age 3 and 4, which is where the primary research on brain development occurs, that is the biggest need. And today we only have about 55% of our students in some kind of a program. That 45%, a great portion of the 20% at grade 3 standards that aren't achieving it are coming out of that 45% that aren't prepared when they come into the formal K-12 system.
The present model includes 3, 4, 5.
Representative Dahlman,
the present model
does not include any pre-K years.
just it's the model today is a silo of the education system. It is K to 12. It does not deal with the issues before and the issues after that formal education.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The last bullet here is develop. I think we really do need to look at this strategically, and that's a state economic model that starts to look at the impact of all of these pieces together on all the other costs, social, corrections, and other issues that we're facing. And I actually put a little chart on your table. A piece of work that we looked at on this particular chart actually shows the impact of four different groups from the standpoint of their education achievement. High school dropouts, high school graduates, some with college and college degree or more. And interesting, if you look at the little light bar on the top of that bar, that represents the amount of taxes, property, income, and other forms of taxes that those people pay on average, those groups. And if you look at the other bar, on average, those are the actual costs, social corrections and other costs that are being incurred. So if you go below, I think there's a real value, economic value issue here that we need to start to equate to our education system, which also drives jobs and other issues in Oregon, is how the cost at each of these levels is affecting the system today in real dollars. And so when we look at investment in education, we should also be looking at the outcome it produces from a revenue standpoint. The efficiency side is there are absolutely, in the model, when we say $7.1 billion, I think everyone jumps up and says that number is too big. You know what? It is, because there are efficiencies to be had, whether it's data consolidation, and here ESD consolidations, healthcare, looking at the delivery systems we have for transportation, special needs, the number of districts we have, teacher training. All of those are ways that we can improve efficiencies, and strategies to deal with those need to be done. But even when you do that, when you look at the governor's report that came out Monday, you won't cover the gap. There's still remediation costs, and there still are other costs that are needed by increased funding within the system because of what we've done over the last few years. Changing the page to the adequacy on page 7, there is, I think, a need to fund education adequately, pre-K to 20, and not just look at K to 12 as a silo, because there are cause and effects on each other level. One of the challenges we have today is we are moving more and more to using local options to fund schools. That has two significant issues, both sustainability and equity. And I think that is a big challenge we all should be looking at. We've tried to actually calculate some of those dollars in the model in the aggregate so that you can see that piece. And we need to develop a strategy around pre-K programs, again, addressing that earlier question at age 3 and 4, to get more of those students at standard so that when they go through the system, the remediation costs are significantly less. Research-based practices is what the model's about, and supporting early reading initiatives, the smaller learning communities, and then really taking a specific look, and which we will be doing in the next session, at some of the middle and high school structures around rigor, relevance, and relationships, and how we can start to move a higher performance and connectivity with community and universities through the system. I don't know if you read the article in the Oregon this morning about AP. We are well under the national average now in AP placement. That's a problem, because that's a lack of connectivity with the other parts of the system and a strategy to move students through. It shouldn't be a fixed-based time frame education. Students ready to move because they have the quality and ability to earn credits in college. They should earn those, and that would take a burden off the K-12 system and a cost from a cost standpoint. The chart below, I think, is just the issue of funding. Looks at the 03-05 original essential budget, which is kind of keeping it as it is. What we ended up with, $4.9 billion. It looks at the same essential budget today, bringing in the cost factors for the PERS pickup, health and other wages, salaries, versus the governor's proposed budget, and then the quality ed model. Again, a number that is based on the current DBI information and the best practices, with some opportunities still in here to do some additional research on efficiencies.
Madam Chair.
Just in this
bar. Are you continuing, or were you wrapping up? Because I have a question. I'd be happy to wait until you're all finished.
Representative Farley, go ahead and ask the question. That's great.
I just have a question for you. What studies have been done to support early intervention of students that are in those at-risk groups?
There are a number, Representative Farr, there's a number of research that has come out. The Packard Group just released a significant study that showed a longitudinal study of students that at age 3 and 4 had a quality education program, special needs students, that showed for each student that went through that program that in the K-12 system they saved $11,000 on each one of those students. And the outcome at the back end was very interesting. For every dollar spent there, there was a 7-to-1 return on those dollars spent in reduced social corrections and other costs that came out the back end. So there is work. There are studies that support those kind of analyses.
Representative
Clark? Actually, I wanted to add to that. The Citizens Crime Commission in Portland did a study related to juvenile justice crime costs and came to the, sort of the same conclusion that money spent in early childhood and pre-K programs, both, including Healthy Start, saved the county on average like 7-to-1 on the dollar.
I'm happy to hear that because I happen to serve on the Success by Six board in Eugene.
That's great. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Representative Don.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would we be, a hypothetical question then, was looking at funding for education and the difficulty, would we be better off if we were to find money now predicated on that statement to put it in pre-K? Would that be the best investment rather than any money we could put together? Would that be the place to apply the money?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, my prevention is always cheaper than intervention and retention, which is the back end of the game. And I think that we have to start looking at those strategies. You know, our current budget that's being proposed has an $11 million cut in early childhood. That's not acceptable. If we're going to start to change this curve, you have to turn the ship. You've got to, you know, someone has to get at the rudder, the front of the ship, and turn it. I mean, we've got to get the process up front started, right? And we're not doing that effectively today. But we have the other problem here is, I think, is that significant breakdown at middle school. That is a very concerning fact. I don't want to leave that off the table because we are when our kids leave the formal structure into a less formal structure, you see the results. Our test scores are dropping. They're disengaged. There's the rigor, the relevance, the relationship issue starts to change significantly there.
I'm confused. We had people in with numbers 2 weeks ago, the Chalkboard Project, telling us that Oregonians and their middle schools did better than average in the nation. Now, I'm getting two sets of numbers here. That's confusing to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlin, I'm looking at longitudinal information about Oregon students. I didn't compare that nationally. I'd have to go back and look at the national stats. But this, again, is looking at over a period of time, that gap is widening.
You can see the frustration because you're telling us that we're falling apart at the middle school. And 2 weeks ago we're told that we're doing better than average in the middle school. And I'm trying to resolve these two figures because it's the same on economic growth. Oregon's not doing well economically. Oregon's doing wonderfully, and I think our job here is to determine where's the best place to apply educational expertise. We now have pre-K would be a good place, but I am confused on this middle school issue. Are we in the middle, above average? Or are we falling apart? That's your term.
Dr. Burke?
Chair, Representative Dahlin, I think I can shed some light on that. There is no single definitive measure. The eighth grade numbers that the Chalkboard Project was looking at and available to anyone on a national comparison, there really is only one measure that is an apples-to-apples measure across the United States. That's the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, that every state in the United States is required to administer the NAEP exams, and they're done at fourth grade and eighth grade. In the most recent report on the NAEP assessment showed Oregon eighth graders doing quite well in the top third of the United States, particularly in mathematics. So on that comparison, Oregon middle school kids are doing well.
Where are we falling apart in middle school then?
if you look at the longitudinal data, as Mr. Thrasher said, the ability to close the achievement gap and the overall acceleration at the 8th grade and particularly at the 10th grade is more flat, is not accelerating at the same rate of improvement as you find at 3rd grade and 5th grade. So it's a question of which set of data do you look at. We are, if you look at the 8th grade data, you see overall improvement from 1996 to the present time. So you're on an upward slope. But is the slope of that line as fast as you see at 3rd grade and 5th grade? And the answer to that is no. So we're not saying that progress is not made at the middle school level, but the ability to close the achievement gap, in fact, what we see at the 8th grade and at the high school level in some groups, the achievement gap actually increases slightly rather than closes at that level. The NAEP data does not look at the data that way. It just looks at overall 8th grade performance.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, I think the issue here is trend. Are we satisfied with the trend that we're seeing there? We should not be. We're not achieving, bringing our middle school and high school students to the performance levels that they should be at.
Chair, thank you. I think part of the problem is one that you mentioned. That's apples and oranges and apples and apples. And the data we're looking at here is over the state testing of our states determine what the standards are. We test our kids. The data is showing that we're flattening out. With respect to NAEP, that's a national test. It's a different testing deal. And it's saying what is good for us to hear. Our kids are doing better than a lot of other kids around the country. But they aren't meeting the standards that we have set. If we set them correctly or not is an issue that we all have to decide. But the reality is, and it has been consistent from the very first testing, the first and second years, the growth in elementary has always been greater than middle school and high school. The gap has widened every year, and it continues to do so, at least in our experience. And we have an obligation, and that's what that other the graph showed at the beginning, that in a few years we have to have 99% up there. And so the graph that middle school and high schools are having to go continues to grow streams much, much faster than what the elementary has to do if they're going to continue to meet their standards and get 99% of the kids there. And there's a whole lot of contributing factors, but one that has been consistent is that issue with respect to the change from small school classroom to the independence of middle school. And, you know, how do we get, and also there's a whole lot of other issues. You know, there's social issues. There's a lot of implications that happen at the middle school level and the high school level that seem to indicate it. But it's frustrating at times when you look at these two different deals. They're different tests
relating
to different kinds of things. So when you get information that's conflicting, it's because we're not talking about apples and oranges. It has been frustrating for a long time. You look at the SAT scores in Oregon, we do very well. We have consistently done very well. So if we take those kids, and we're one of the states that has more than 30% taking the test. So in those tests, we continue to do very well. That doesn't mean we're doing as well as we should, and in particular, when it comes to the disaggregated groups. That is also another area, including poverty, where it's becoming, the gap is not closing, and we need to figure out what we have to put into the system to get that gap to close.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
May I just make one comment, and I'm sure everyone else has already made this assumption, but I would assume that part of the reason why we're seeing this inconsistency in comparison with other states is we have a lower percentage of students per capita in those at-risk groups. So there's your explanation.
Pardon me. Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Farr, that is correct. And there's a bit of good news about NAEP. Be happy to share all of these results with the committee at your pleasure. The NAEP results did indicate that Oregon African American students were increasing at a rate that was significantly better than the rest of the country. So we felt that some of the targeting, particularly in some of our urban areas, was paying off in middle school mathematics. We're very pleased with those results.
Madam Chair, if I might, the seeming inconsistency in the data is in reality not an inconsistency at all. I think if you look at the relative performance of middle schoolers versus elementary school students in other states, you'll see the same pattern that we see in Oregon. A significant drop-off in student performance relative to the standards. Oregon just happens to be doing above average in that regard, but the lesson here is that no state is doing well with their middle schoolers or their high schoolers. We just happen to be a bit above average, but we're still doing much less than we, much lower than our expectations and much lower than we'd like to be doing. The data are not inconsistent at all. It may on the surface seem like a paradox, but when you consider that all states are doing poorly with their middle schoolers, you know, to be slightly above average in a group where everyone is doing poorly is really not something to cheer about. More relevant and I think more concerning for us is that we see this dramatic drop off when students hit middle school.
We have another testing system, and that's the No Child Left Behind should give us some info. How do we do with that scale?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, it's not a separate testing system. It is the same system and the same scale. The No Child Left Behind accountability system requires states to set a threshold or a target between 2001 and 2014 that would stair-step to that 100% proficiency. And the target for the first 3 years in Oregon was a 40% meeting or exceeding standard. And that threshold is applied to elementary, middle, and high school. For the current school year, the 04-05 school year, the threshold will be 50%. So there will be additional calculations this year. The question of how we are doing on that, there are 1,250 schools in the state. Out of that number, 356, if I'm recalling from memory, I can get you the exact number when I get to my computer, did not make what's called adequate yearly progress. That's whether or not they met that threshold. And of that number, about a third of those schools were schools that qualified for federal Title I assistance. So about a third of the schools were Title I schools. Two-thirds of the schools were non-Title I schools. And because this measure, and Madam Chair, we did not have a chance to talk about NCLB in detail, and I'll be happy to come back and explain this, that because the calculations, Representative Dahlem, are calculated on each subgroup in the school, when you get to high schools where subgroups have come together from multiple schools into a single school and you have a larger population, what we've seen is that it has been harder for the high schools in the state to have each subgroup, and I'm talking about special education, limited English proficiency, poverty, and each racial and ethnic group, hitting that same 40% threshold. And under the No Child Left Behind Act, if I miss on one, I miss the whole thing. So we actually have a relatively small number of high schools that made adequate yearly progress on all of those characteristics.
How did our middle schools do?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, middle schools did better, but again, every time you concentrate subgroups from elementary schools into middle school or middle school into high school, and you get larger populations, just statistically, you're going to have more opportunity not to meet the threshold, and that happens in the numbers. I have a complete breakdown of elementary, middle, and high school. I'll be happy to get it for you. That information, by the way, both for the committee and for the public, by going to our website, both for the state report card and the adequate yearly progress report for every school and every district for the past 5 years is available on the website. You can look at any school or any district on all of those reports.
And Dr. Burke, just for your information, realizing that your No Child Left Behind presentation was significantly cut in half, I do have a list of questions that Mr. Keller will be getting to you that I would like to have addressed. some of that in regard to the assessment statement you just made, but more fully in regard to the end of yearly progress components.
Great. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Madam Chair, I think the other thing that I think a lot of people don't seem to understand in No Child Left Behind is that they compare states, but that's a difficult comparison because every state has different standards. So we are the only state in the union that uses the tests we use to base our No Child Left Behind on. There is no other state that uses the same tests that we do to meet the standard for No Child Left Behind. Every other state has their own state standards, their own state tests that they are using to meet the standard. So at the end, when we get to the standard, we're supposed to have 99%. Those 99% were our Oregon students meeting Oregon standards, Washington kids meeting Washington standards, Texas kids meeting Texas standards, all of which can be different. So it's very difficult to compare one state to the other with regard to the how the progress that's being made towards meeting those standards. And I think those are some very frustrating parts of the system. And the other one, in answer to the middle schools, large schools in the state of Oregon have done atrocious with respect to meeting the standard, and it's almost exclusively one group of students, the special needs students, who are not, who by the time they get to high school, you have 20 or more of them in a class. Prior to that, you didn't have that many in any class. They weren't a subgroup. They become a subgroup. And it's the same thing as happening to districts, because there's also a district report card based on the total in the district, and that one generally falls below what's happening with individual schools, and it's all about the subgroups.
And we will have that
really
big, more expanded discussion as we move to the more completed conversation about No Child Left Behind. So, did you have further?
Yeah, I'll just go. I'll go real quick because I know your time is important. On page 8, it's just kind of the funding trends on the inflation-adjusted basis per student. As you can see, that has actually declined in the last few years at a time when the student populations, the demographics of our student base have changed drastically with respect to needs-based students, et cetera. So I think that's an important thing to look at when you look at cost structure and the impact it has from the funding side. On page 9 is just the implications with the proposed budget that came out. There will be, and I think the governor's report Monday says that, there will be larger class sizes and cuts. And he gave three alternative ways, and you can look at those, and I won't go through them specifically, but it will have these impacts on the current system at a time when we're trying to move standards and move toward No Child Left Behind outcomes. We're actually, I think, going to have an impact that will show those curves flattening and dropping further. And then if you are looking at policy change, Brian put together a nice chart here just on summarizing, if you make specific changes, here are the dollars that are imposed with those changes on a biennium based on class size changes, length of school year, et cetera. So those are just some examples for your use. So in summary,
Chair, may I ask quick question on this? One of the things we talked about was pre-K education, and I don't see this listed here. Am I missing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we did not take a cut on pre-K because, if you know, the model is made on K-12. We brought up the issue because one of the things in governance that we really believe is a term called reciprocal accountability. We need to get that built in. That's where we don't pass students between grades or between silos. That would be pre-K, K-12, community college, four-year colleges, without accountability forwards and backwards. That's teacher accountability, that's system accountability, at student accountability, and be able to measure that so that from the data you can actually make policy change. That's where we have not addressed that in this report because it wasn't the purview of what number we had to produce for you from this report. We raised the issue. It's a the next phase of study we would recommend.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, there is extensive information on early childhood programs and the implication of both the Oregon Pre-K program and the federal Head Start mm-hmm. program, where we try to match funds and expend availability. What I would suggest to the committee, we might want to have a separate conversation with you about the Oregon Pre-K program and federal Head Start and go into some detail about what we're spending and the number of students being served. Nancy Latini, the assistant superintendent of our staff, would be happy to review that with the committee.
Thank you. That's an excellent recommendation.
It is, because I look at those figures, 7-1 return for every dollar we would spend, it seems like that would be a good, efficient way to spend our dollars. So I'd love to hear that.
We will.
Thank you.
One question.
Representative Lynn.
As I look at the chart you have given me, page, let me see, page four, and we are funding the same amount of money to each student, same opportunity, same atmosphere, but it seems to me that the Caucasian and Asians exceed well, and always that the Afro-Americans and Hispanics always lower. Why these things are happening? We're giving them the same opportunity, same amount of money, but some are failing, some are just succeeding. Mm-hmm. I think this is the fundamental issue we need to take account. The reason why I'm saying it is that they are always asking more money, it will help, but that's not the only answer. That's my thought. How do you explain that?
Madam Chair, Representative Blum, I think when you look at the disaggregation of this data, one of the things you start to have to look at is the issues of poverty, the issues of language, ESL requirements, and the issue of special needs within each of the groups, because each of those will have an impact. Hispanic students, they're probably a larger percentage of special language needs, ESL needs. So I think we have to, again, just keep disaggregating this down to what the cause is, because if any subgroup has more poverty, more special language needs, more special needs, because of their economic situation in many senses, that can cause this performance issue. And so, Pat, you probably can better report on that. But, I mean, those are issues that we have to look at on each one of these subgroups.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I think if you look at the long history of research into those factors that affect student performance, money in the school system is one of them, but a great many of them, and they're the ones Ken just mentioned, poverty, cultural background, circumstances at home for children, whether they're from a single-parent family or not, language barriers, a great many things that are outside the control of the school system have a large impact on how well students do in school. So the question is, what's the solution? We know that what goes on in school cannot be the entire solution to the achievement gap. But the reality is many of those things are outside the control of the school system.
So part of that is looking at the delivery system and how if we had a personal education plan for students, we'd early on identify those kind of issues quicker and bring whatever, and they may not be school services, they may be social services provided in the community. They may be programs like SMART with early reading and early pre-K being connected earlier into the program instead of later where it is today. So all of those have become part of the strategies to affect that longitudinal line that we're trying to bring up to No Child Left Behind standards.
May I comment, Madam Chair? I think I concur with you that the many factors comes from the outside instead of inside, such as a culture, and economic, plus many others. And as far as their language is concerned, I'm from Asia. I came here when I was 30 years old. I have still difficulty in expressing my thought.
But, no.
I do. Anyway, Asian students, most of them come from Asia, but even though they are not speaking English well, they do well in English and math, especially math is the highest among all other people. And so we need to look at the funding issue. I know is more is better, but we need to look at the issues outside from this education area, such as a parental involvement. And in Asia, the parents' involvement very important, sometimes more involvement than it needs to be. That's one of the problems we have other countries about that. I think if we want to solve the problem, we need to look at go outside the box and look at the total issue, not just the funding issue alone. And that's what I'm just talking about. That's what I'd like to suggest.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, can I make one comment here? Because I think in the model, you will see a discussion around quality indicators. those are about 12 different factors that describe many of the things, Representative Lynn, that you just asked about: parental involvement, connectivity with the school, after school, dealing with latchkey kids. Those are issues that in the future model we want to start to quantify, because within a school, as we look at adequate yearly progress, if you can measure those, they become those things that you can actually create strategies around and create change with. And that's where we want to, as one of the areas that we're studying right now, and how to better measure those kind of things to do what you're talking about.
Thank you.
Our recommendations are on the last page. We've already talked about all of them, so I won't repeat those. And you can take a look at those, but we really appreciate the opportunity today.
Madam Chair, just a quick response to Representative Lim. Representative, this is an area that we have been spending a great deal of time on as an agency, the whole idea of cultural competence and how do schools respond to differences in culture and poverty, gender, and other factors that influence student performance. Would love an opportunity to come before the committee and review with you what we're doing. You'll also find that the Oregon College and University community is also embrace this as an agenda. There's a lot of activity in our state going on right now on this issue, and I would certainly concur with your analysis. This goes way beyond money. This is a much more complex factor, but there is a lot happening in the state, and we'd be happy to share that with you.
We'll be back to you. And Mr. Reeder, did you have a final comment?
Representative Flores, no.
Well, I will just take us back to the numbers very quickly. Having looked at Exhibit M in your report and the essential budget level number and hydraulic and the assumptions there, I note that you have indicated much of the increase is due to rising health insurance and FERS retirement system costs. And so, indeed, those are two other significant policy areas that affect the very thing that we're talking about in regard to numbers.
Madam Chair, I think that's an important element you just described, because I think in education we also have to look at what causes a cost increase. Is it federally mandated? Is it state mandated? Is it state controlled? Is it local controlled? Each of those elements can affect a district's operation, and we need to understand where all those come from, because they have an impact, a hidden impact, often on the school's budget that may or may not add any value. And so we really, I think, need to understand what we're requiring schools to do.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Mr. Spasher, I only have advanced placement and English as second language, AP and ESL, on your tab, so thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you very much for spending time today.
Madam Chair, you got me thinking, and I do have something to say to conclude with.
Give them an inch.
One of the goals of the Quality Ed Commission is to get the model out there for people to use, and I am prepared to provide each of you with a copy of the model and a demonstration and training session and so forth if you want that, and I'm happy to come to your office and provide that to you so you can better understand the model. I think the point Ken closed with is that understanding which of the cost drivers are within our control and which are not, and which increases in funding add our capacity to benefit students and which don't, is one of the roles the model plays here, is it really opens up the funding system to some very close scrutiny, and that's one of its key benefits, and I'm very happy to show you how you can use the model to do that.
Thank you. I'm very much looking forward to that. Representative
Moore? Yeah, following up on that, Madam Chair, maybe we could do a demonstration live with all of us here to, you know, maybe the rest of the folks could, if that works into your...
We can explore that. I don't know if we have the technological capacity to do it. Maybe we do.
I think probably do.
Okay, then.
If we can get on the Internet from the room, we could do that.
Yeah.
Check.
We can check that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
I know.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, that's why we have Jim here today.
Well, another component of... The public school discussion is in regard to charter schools, and we have some presenters with us today if they'd come forward. Now, I'm not sure if it's Mr. Green or Mr. Kramer, but I heard two. So you might just bring your money right up here.
It's also Ms.
Here. Who's going to begin today? Or is Joey. Mr. Green, did you want to come forward as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joni Gillis from the Oregon Department of Education, and I thank you for inviting me here to give you the statewide overview of our public charter school program. I'd like to go over real quickly the contents of the packet that you have before you. The first is a PowerPoint presentation, and I will be referring to that throughout my time. Then there is a list of the charter schools that are in operation for the 2004-2005 school year. Then there's a map that you can kind of get an idea of the activity throughout the state by county and then by school district. And then we also have the charter school handbook that has a lot of the policies and a lot of kind of the nitty-gritty. So that is some of the materials. And I'd like to begin with the PowerPoint presentation. Just to give you an idea of the law was put into effect in 1999. We have 56 charter schools in operation as of this date, educating approximately 5,700 students. They are a variety of special focus and grade configurations everywhere from Montessori, Waldorf. We have several language immersion programs, quite a few dropout recovery programs, alternative programs at the high school level, many types of grade configurations. We have some K-2 schools, some K-12, some 6-12, some 4-8, so they're quite unique. We have one charter that was terminated for health and safety reasons, six that were either not renewed or dissolved by either the charter school board or the local school district. Two have been sponsored by the State Board of Education, Four Rivers in Ontario and Victory Middle School in Portland Public, and then we have had two applications that have been denied by the state school board. On the next slide gives you some graphic information on kind of the trend from 1999 to 2004, so you can see totally how many charter schools have been opened and then the year that they were closed. And then another, the charter school law was written to give community members, parents, educators an opportunity to take some responsible risks in creating an opportunity. And we've had four groups that we try and that the charter school operators have kind of fallen into, or excuse me, the developers. One is the startup. These are community members, a lot of them that have not been involved in education or teachers that maybe are very interested in a specific program or specific focus and have worked kind of outside of the school district to start up. We call those startup schools. We have some conversion schools. The law allows for both public and private alternative schools to convert as long as they're non-tuition based. And we have district-initiated schools. You can see in 03 and 04, we've had more district-initiated charters as districts have taken a look at the charter vehicle to provide more opportunities for their students. And then another category are schools that have been facing closure by the local school district boards for mainly for cost cutting. Celeste is a good example, Eddyville, Bethany Charter, and the communities have come together and said that this school is the heart of our community. What can we do to try and keep the school in our community? They've looked to chartering, and so we have about, I think, five of those. So that kind of gives you an idea of the four different categories. Then on page four, we will have available probably within the next month an evaluation of the charter schools that were open last year. So I think that's about 42 of them. This is just an example of the kind of information that will be in this evaluation. This one happens to ask, why did you or your family choose the charter school? So we're going to get a lot of interesting information on the choice issue, why staff are choosing charter schools, some budget information, and this is just kind of a preview on whetting your appetite so that we can, then we'll get the report to you within probably a month. Accountability is huge for charter schools. As you know, the whole premise of charter school is autonomy, some flexibility, in exchange for accountability. And these are just some examples of how charter schools are held accountable in our state. They all have to meet adequate yearly progress. They all get a school report card. For each grant site, each charter school that receives a grant, they have to show evidence that they have a conflict of interest in ethics policy in place before they receive grant funds. They do annual reports, annual audits, and evaluations. So these are just some of the examples and some of the information that we're beginning to collect to show how charter schools as a group are doing and how charter schools are doing relative to their districts and to the state. And the next slide is another preview of the information that we will be including in our evaluation. We're going to take some more time to analyze the data, to look at the subpopulations, the subgroups, to take a look at the different types of programs and how the students are doing relative to those programs, compare some of them to districts. So this is just kind of the first cut at the charter schools that have been in operation for 2 years or more and how they do at the reading and math state assessment level.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note the drop-off we see in statewide schools and charter schools is parallel, except for the precipitous drop in the meeting or exceeding math assessment. And that is very troubling to see that big of a drop. Down to 19% of those folks. Do you think that's a reflection of the size of the schools and not able to attract faculty maybe that have that broader or more technical math skills that we're shooting for in our standards, or is it just something with maybe we're better off with charter schools that specialize in K-8?
Madam Chair, Representative March, most of the charter schools that serve high school students serve the at-risk high school students. So if we took, and that's one thing that we want to do, we want to take a look at the charter schools that serve these at-risk populations and then compare them to the programs or other schools that serve the same type of populations. Still 19% is not acceptable, but I think if we showed that, you're absolutely correct, the grade schools, as you can see, the grade schools are doing much better. The high schools are for much more of the at-risk, kinds of alternative type programs. So we're going to do a little bit more analysis on
still
that.
Digging in. Thank you.
You're welcome. On page six, we have some preliminary data on the adequate yearly progress and how our charter schools are doing. We're finding that because charter schools start out, a lot of them start out fairly small, that some, we don't have data on some of the schools because the cell size just isn't large enough to do that. So I think as the schools continue to grow and our charter school population continues to grow, we'll be able to add much more information to this. We have a federal charter school grant program. Over since 1999, we've received about $26 million for incentive and dissemination grants. 95% of these funds go to the charter school developers in term for to help with their planning and to help with the first 2 years of implementation. We've awarded 116 incentive grants, so we've got 56 schools that are opening or that are opened, but we have a lot more that are kind of in the works. They have 18 months from when they receive their first planning funds to then be granted a charter, so they've got 18 months for the planning. We've also awarded 9 dissemination grants. The charter school has to be in operation for 3 years, and then they are eligible to apply for a dissemination grant. And the thinking on that is some of their best practices. How have they best served these at-risk students, or how have they dealt with governance issues or some curriculum development? And then they can apply for a grant, and then they can disseminate this information to other public charter schools or other schools throughout the state. From the ODE perspective, we feel that the charter school law is working at 5 years and 56 schools, so we're very pleased with that. We have found, as the data shows, that districts working with community members are using charter schools as one strategy to provide school choice. We are finding that there is a tension between this the charter school law, which encourages flexibility and innovation, and this more rigid No Child Left Behind law. And so we're, in terms of teacher licensure and some of the other kinds of components, so we are providing technical assistance to kind of figure out how to keep the intent of the charter school law and still meet the expectations of No Child Left Behind. In Oregon, we have a very rigorous evaluation process. And I think the charter school developers and school boards would, school districts would agree with that, because once a charter is granted, we are these developers are expected to run a school, and all the different variety of activities that goes into running a school. The evaluation process has to be a good faith evaluation, but we also feel it should be very rigorous, and there should be tough questions that are asked and the ability to answer those tough questions. The implementation policies, this is just a list of some of the Oregon administrative rules that have been put in place to kind of flesh out this sometimes confusing and conflicting charter school legislation. So we've put from the review and approval process all the way to what happens to the assets of the charter school once it is closed. How do you deal, you know, how do you dispose of those assets? Some of the issues and challenges that we're finding, the first one, within the context of diminishing resources, we're finding that the role of the sponsor can be somewhat onerous. A district staff, usually an evaluation, is reviewed by no less than a special ed person, a curriculum person, a fiscal person, and several other educators. And that's a lot of time and energy at the district level if you really want to do a thorough and critical evaluation. So we're trying to work with districts and the developers to try and give them some technical assistance on how best to do the evaluation. The law does not define value and does not define adverse impact, although it asks us to weigh those two in creating charter schools. And so I think we're getting closer to having some definition of what that is, but that's been a bit of a challenge. The readiness of charter school operators, it calls for a wide range of expertise, from dispensing medicine, student records, field trips, trip forms, just everything. And sometimes charter school developers, the vision is the exciting part, but the implementation sometimes can be a little bit chaotic. And so once again, we're trying to provide as much technical assistance to the charter school startup folks to say, this is, in terms of dispensing medication, or here's a legal field trip form, or, those types of things. Also, the role of the State Board of Education. I hope I won't be fined for acronyms on the paper.
On the paper, sorry.
Okay. I just found that out from my dear friend. The role of the State Board of Education in the appeal process. Right now, we are recommending, and it's Senate Bill 166, that a third option be added, and that is for the State Board of Education to be able to remand a proposal that comes to us if they haven't followed the correct procedure, or if they have not done a good faith evaluation using the criteria set forth in the law. We are asking to have a third option, and that is to remand to the district and say, we find that you're, to give us a little authority to be able to ask a district to review it again. And finally, we have a list of some of the state sponsored activities, and these are usually done in conjunction with, in partnership with the Oregon School Board Association, with the Oregon Charter School Service Center, and the Charter School Development Center. So we really all try and work together to assist the startup and implementation of charter schools. I sure appreciate the opportunity to present this information and welcome any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This really isn't a question, but it's just curious to me that the unintended consequences, we're trying to cut down administrative costs and everything that we're dealing with in the legislature, especially in education, and look at the administrative costs that we've added to the charter school concept. It's just interesting to me that obviously adding to your workload.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I see the presentation here, we have about 57,000 students in the 56 school, charter schools.
5,700 students.
Yeah, 5,700 in the 56 schools. That means 102 students at each charter school, if it's divided by the equal number. I'd like to find out that what is the biggest charter school we have and what's the smallest charter school?
First
question.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, the handout that I gave you that has a list of all the charter schools with their grade configuration, I believe that the largest one, I think we have one that's about 200 New Urban Oregon Coast Technology Schools, 260, Sand Ridge is 224, so we have some, probably five or six that are 200 and above.
Okay.
The average is 100, and by law, they have to have a minimum of 25 students. We have a few charter schools that are in the 30s, and usually the charter, each year they grow another class, so they might start out with 30 students, and the next year they might be adding, say, the third grade and the fourth grade. So we have quite a few. In fact, that would be interesting information to give you to show how some of the charter schools started at 30 and now are at 75 and 80, okay. Just to show you that.
Okay. One more question, Madam Chair. So I'd like to hear your opinion. What's the trend in the future? I was a senator when we instituted charter schools, and there has been a fear in the education field, charter school might take away a lot of students from the public schools. So there has been a lot of opposition on this issue, but it didn't happen that way. what's your estimation trend in the future? Is it going to get bigger or smaller, or is it going to go away?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, and I would really welcome the other presenters, you know, their opinion on this also. I think that you know, the trend has been with 17 last year and another 18 this year, whatever the numbers were, that for the next few years, I think as long as we have the federal incentive grant, that is an incentive for charter schools to use those funds to do the planning and to do the implementation, we are going to apply for another 3-year funding at the end of this year. I would think it might taper out somewhat, so we might not see the each year the 15, 16, 17, but I would imagine as communities take a look at really the needs of their students, and I think some of the accountability, the school report card and the adequate yearly progress reports are showing subpopulations that might need a different type of educational setting, that we'll see a consistent increase of charter schools, but maybe not the large ones that we've had just the last few years. So I maybe I've talked around that, but I would think that there would be a steady opening of charter schools, maybe 5 or 6 a year, something like that. Because I don't know at what point there's a saturation.
Thank you, Dan.
Madam Chair, did you have a question? You go ahead.
No, Representative Favre, Representative Robeson, I was actually going to ask Mr. Green if he had a comment there, but you're welcome to pop in.
I have a question for you. If you can tell me, do most charter schools provide school lunch programs and transportation to and from the school?
Madam Chair, Representative Favre, most of the charter schools, I would need to get the exact numbers. The charter schools, I believe most of them provide at least the elementary schools are part of the school lunch program. Most of them work with their district on that. A few of them have contracted with outside providers. In terms of transportation, quite a few of the charter schools have worked with the district a district doesn't have to add to a bus route or add a bus route, but if there's space available on the bus, the charter school students can ride the bus. Some of the charter schools also have used some funding to purchase city bus passes, especially at the middle and high school level. That would be another interesting, and I think that was one of the questions we ask on the evaluation, to see what types of transportation opportunities they do provide for their students.
I have one other question. It's actually not a follow-up, but it's just something that I'm confused about. What is the difference between a charter school and an in-district alternative school?
Madam Chair, Representative Favre, a charter school operates because it is granted a charter to operate. A district alternative program is created by the district and can be closed by the district, actually, for funding or for whatever reasons. A charter school has to follow a very specific application process. There's, 20-plus different types of questions that have to be answered. It has to be approved by the local board. They have a separate operating board. I think the handbook that I gave you would really kind of spell out the uniqueness of a charter school as opposed to an alternative program or even an alternative school within a district.
Thank you,
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. And again, I just want to say, I don't know how many people I've worked with Joni for a number of years, because we started a charter school and I was on the beginning of one. And having an advocate at the state level who truly believed in getting it done and helping people do things was pretty remarkable. And I commend her for the work she's done, Mr. Green, a North Thing resident, also from our area. But the thing that I think that has been important in this whole process was that there was a real effort by the state to work with districts and to work with charter schools and to play that fine role between each of them. And I don't know that anybody could have done it better than Joni. So that was just a comment to a person that I watched work over the last number of years. And it was really neat to see her here today. So I just wanted to say thanks. I think funding is another area that's very different between charter school and the alternative school.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gillis, and we appreciate you, too.
Well, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, OSBA, from here on out. I almost want to write you a check, Madam Chair, just to have a credit with the committee, because I feel I may fall into the acronym, and I'll try not to. And for the record, that was Rob Kramer's phone that went off twice in the back of the area.
$2.
I offered to go to collect.
Back in 1999, when this piece of legislation was passed, it's now in statute in ORS Chapter 338, the Oregon School Boards Association supported the bill. And we were the only state school board association across the nation that supported a piece of charter school legislation that came out of the legislature. And we continue to support this legislation. We've worked very hard with our school boards to try to get them to understand what this law means. And Joni mentioned with you some of the challenges that are out there. And one of the challenges we had to face right away was we had some recalcitrant school districts out there that said, you know, what's a charter school? What does it mean? And are they in competition with this? And we had to do a great deal of in-service with our school boards and our school districts on that, and we continue to do that. We received a call just a couple of days ago from the Brookings Harbor School District, who is getting an application, and Chris Nichols, who's the superintendent down there, she's never had to deal with this, and called our shop and said, what is this? Well, we're going to send two folks down there to do an in-service with their administrative team and their board. It'll take about 6 hours to do that. As Joni said, we have 56 charter schools, and to get to Representative Lim's question, I see them growing quite a bit in the next couple of years. Right now, I kind of call this the chartering season in the state of Oregon, because applications have been put in by districts, and they're in the process of reviewing those. And some have been approved already by school districts. St. Helens has one that they've approved. Sherwood has one, and I just heard from Mr. Kramer, and he'll explain this to you later. Scio has one, which will be the largest charter school in the state, and I don't want to steal any of his thunder with that, so I'll let him explain that school to you. And we have several other applications pending currently in several school districts across the state. I see probably next year, if I had to guess, upwards of about 70 charter schools in the state of Oregon, growing at some point in the next 2 to 3 years to the number 100, and maybe beyond that. But at some point, we will hit a saturation level. But Representative Lim, I see them growing quite a bit in the next 3 to 4 or 5 years until we get to about 100. Some of the issues that I know you're going to hear about and some of the issues that you may have heard about from some of your constituents who may be running charter schools or from school districts that have a charter school surround the issues of renewal. Our statute doesn't address that issue. What do you do with an up-and-running charter school, and what do you do when you want to renew that? In the districts that I've represented in their charter school negotiations, I always make sure we put in the contract or the charter agreement something around renewal. Generally, in the terms of if they meet their charter agreement and they comply with all state and federal laws surrounding charter schools, then they would be renewed for an additional term. I know that's an issue for charter school folks, because one of the other issues they have to deal with is finding a facility. And part of the problem they have is going out and getting credit in order to purchase or rent a facility. And if they're not granted a long-term charter, a lender is a little bit looking at them askew, saying, well, we don't know you're going to be around that long. So I know those are issues that are going to be dealing with. And in the area of facilities, we've tried to do some unique partnerships, but it is one of the largest challenges that a charter school applicant will face. And we have schools where I can think of the Petey School, which is a charter school here in the Dallas area. They had a school out in an outlying community called Petey. And that district shut that school down for a variety of reasons. It was losing students. And a group out there said, this is our community. And I think Joni relayed this in several communities. We lose that school, we lose our sense of community. Well, that school district said, let's rent it to them for a buck. And that way they do the upkeep. We don't have to send folks out to make sure the windows aren't being broken, nobody's broken in and put graffiti on the walls. So I know that's one of the issues that we're going to try to deal with. There is some federal money available for charter school facilities, and we're investigating with the Department of Education on how to access that federal money. As you know, for school districts, We have to go to our local property taxpayers when we want to do anything with our facilities, and unfortunately, charter schools don't have that ability. They're not a taxing entity in the state. As I mentioned, we do charter contracts, and I think that is the most critical aspect of a charter school. You can get the application, and as you read through RS Chapter 338, as Joni said, it's a rigorous process. We didn't want folks to just say, hey, we got this great idea, let's go run a school. It takes a lot to put an application together, and you can ask Rob Kramer about that because he helps groups put the application together. But that charter, that contract that's written up, is the key document. And early on, Representative Dahlem, I know you did some work with charter schools. We looked at the first contracts. They were about 6 pages and didn't cover enough, to be honest with you. And now we have Michener-esque 46-page contracts that are out there. But they are very comprehensive, and they do need to be comprehensive. And one of the things that I've told my school boards across the state is you're going to entrust folks with two things that the public holds near and dear to their heart, their kids and their money. Be sure that anybody you enter into a contract with understands that responsibility and that they meet those standards. And one of the key elements in a charter is the accountability standard. And we really wrestled with this in the early parts of charter schools in the state. How do you address that? And in most instances, what we see is they compare their students to the same group of kids in the normal public schools. That's one way to do it. One of the other ways to do it is to say test them at the beginning of the year, and then test them at the end of the year and see if there's growth in knowledge. That's a very labor-intensive process. That's a very expensive process. We do have charter schools and districts that are doing that. But if you'd like to take a look at a charter contract, a sample one, I could sure make that available to the committee. You'll see everything in there from transportation, Representative Farr, to how food service is going to be provided, to how students will be dealt with when they need to be suspended or expelled from the charter school, and will they be allowed back into the district. One of the things that Joni mentioned, and it's very important, is everybody has a pretty good idea what it takes to educate students. But what we're finding with charter folks is when it comes to running a school, that's where the rubber hits the road. And, you know, school districts have volumes of policies and procedures about what happens when a ballast that has, you know, gas in it breaks. What do you do for student safety? Those are things that charter folks have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. One of the issues that I know came up was, my gosh, we don't have a policy on what happens when the parent doesn't come to pick up the kid at the end of the school day. And school districts have procedures in place with that. Luckily, our school boards have been pretty open on saying, hey, here's our policies and procedures. Take what you want. Because we want to make sure, one, our kids are safe, and two, we're doing the things we need to do. One of the things we found very helpful early on, and I don't think Joni mentioned it, that handbook that you have is put together by a committee, the Oregon Charter School Task Force, which was put together by the Oregon Department of Education. And it has a variety of folks on it, which include people who run charter schools, district folks, myself, Rob Kramer, Joni, and we bring in Jim Keller's been to that meeting, and we address the tough issues that come up. And believe me, there were various and sundry ones that come up in this process. And it's been a pretty good program. The other thing that I would say is this is a law that's being used and should be used by school districts as an additional tool in their toolkit of providing educational services to boys and girls. And the most unique example I'll give you are two right now. One up in the metro area, which is a coalition, and Representative Flores, I believe it's in your district, which is the Center for Advanced Learning, or CAL. That was a coordination of the Gresham Barlow School District, Reynolds School District, Corbett School District, David Douglas School District, and Mount Hood Community College to come together to perform a somewhat of a professional technical school. They even passed bonds in two of the school districts to build the building. The other unique one I'd share with you is what's going on in Paisley. Under our law, we have the ability to have charter school districts. We have two in the state now. One is Paisley and one is Camas Valley down in Douglas County. Paisley did it because they saw it as a way to keep their school district alive. They were simply losing too many kids. They were losing funds because of declining enrollment, and they saw it as a way to access federal funds and to get community buy-in for that school. So in communities across the state, they're using it in a unique and variety of ways. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And, Madam Chair, if your committee would like to take a look at a sample contract, I'd be happy to share that with the administrator.
Thank you. I would like that. Any questions for Mr. Green? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we are going to bring forward, you can both come up, Aaron Tice and Rob Kramer. And I think that Hold on now. If the committee would indulge us by a few minutes, I'll you can go ahead and make it out. I was going to divide the time up in maybe 12 minutes each. Would that be
sure?
Simple? Thank you.
Okay. My name is Karen Hikas, and I am with the Charter Schools Development Center, which is CSDC from now on, if that's okay. I was given a heads up about the tax on acronyms, and I do have a few ones. So.
A tax? He called it a
tax. Madam Chair.
This is not a new tax.
This is amazing.
We call them fines.
Fine tariff.
Well, fine then.
I do have some $1 bills, so if I violate, I'm okay. I have not had the opportunity to address you before, so I do appreciate this opportunity very much. My background is as a public educator. I have taught middle school and high school both in this state, Washington State, and overseas in Indonesia. And I have been a public school administrator now for about the past 10 years, working in ESDs, primarily on alternative education initiatives and issues and charter school programs. And I do want to give some kudos to our prior two speakers, because over the last several years I have worked with a variety of charter schools to develop them and get them started off the ground, and Joni Gillis and Jim Green both have just been valuable partners in that process, both for districts and for charter school developers. They have just helped us over and over again, so I just want to really go on the record and the video acknowledging that support. The Charter Schools Development Center may be familiar to some of you if you were in the legislature in 98 and 99 when the law was written, because they did come up and provide some technical advising as we designed the law. For those of you who are not familiar with the Charter Schools Development Center, it is the largest and best and oldest charter school resource center in the nation. Provides technical assistance, advocacy, all sorts of resources, has helped to start charter school laws and charter school resources in about 25 states around the country. Also has worked in a variety of other countries on charter school issues, which was a surprise to me. There actually are other countries with charter school laws and charter schools, including Qatar. So, that is CSDC, and CSDC has been in Oregon mostly to provide technical assistance over the last couple of years, come in to do workshops at the request of the Department of Education and so forth, and we've really been trying to get them to come kind of on a larger scale and a longer-term basis to Oregon, and so we finally have decided to do that, and they hired me as of January 1 to be the director in Oregon. So we're new in Oregon, but not new in the country, and we are working with charter school developers, charter school operators, charter school sponsors. We're very committed to working with all parties involved. We're very into we work together to develop quality schools and sustain them and serve our students. I'm a public educator, and I believe in options within the system, and I'm very much into collaboration, and so is charter schools, the Charter Schools Development Center. We do have a series of groups that are statewide and consist of developers, operators, sponsors. We have a steering committee, we have an advocacy committee, and we have a technical assistance committee, which are driving the direction for CSDC in Oregon in terms of the services that we provide, our priorities in terms of advocacy, and we are still exploring our role in advocacy, but our two key priorities right now are the exact two that Jim Green mentioned to you: renewal language in the law and facilities. Our law allows for a maximum of a 5-year charter, and our law is 5 years old, so we're kind of at the time that we're dealing with a lot of charter renewals, and the language in the law is really not there. So we're interested in seeing some clarity both for the sponsors and for the charter schools, perhaps process, timeline, and so forth, and very committed and interested in partnering with everyone else to explore the creative options to address the facilities needs of charter schools. That's basically my piece. I'm available to provide information to you. Be happy to come to your office, meet with your staff. I've given you my handout, which is our flyer, which has our website, which is pretty extensive, and the types of services that we are here to provide overall. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Hikas? Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Before you start or after when you leave?
I will pay in person in your office, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about one of my favorite subjects in charter schools in Oregon. As you know, I've been involved with charter schools for almost 10 years now, first in the 95, then 97 legislature trying to get a charter school law passed. We were, of course, successful in 1999. Soon after that law passed, I started the Oregon Charter School Service Center, which seeks to help charter school developers start up their charter schools. It's a gargantuan task starting a charter school. There's nobody that has the set of skills necessary to go from start to finish and get a school up and running. It requires the committed effort of not just the education side, but lots of people with lots of different skills. And we, in the last 5 years, have been involved with more than 50 charter school development projects and are currently involved in at least a half a dozen. It's been very rewarding to me to see the energy that has been released amongst professional educators by the charter school law. People who perhaps felt that their skills were not completely taken advantage of in the current system, and they are allowed now for the first time to realize their own professional dream and to run their own school. Because I think some of the best charter schools out there are run by teachers from the public school system that see another type of public school that they can start to better reach their own dream, which almost always is for the academic benefit of children. It's been very, very rewarding work. I, too, just like Joni Gillis and Jim Green, I think that Oregon's charter law is successful. We're pleased with the growth that we've seen in the charter schools in Oregon. If you compare charter school growth in Oregon to that of other states like Colorado and California, states that may be considered the kind of leaders in the charter school field, actually Oregon's chartering rate per 1,000 students over the first 5 years of our law compares favorably to both Colorado and to California. And I think that's a testimony to a couple of things. Number one, we had a law that actually thought through a lot of things and learned from the mistakes some other states made in how the law was constructed. Number two, I think we can attribute some of the success to our law to the attitude that's been taken on by the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon School Boards Association in very good faith, cooperatively trying to make the charter school law a success. And I think we've kind of been, in some regards, a model to the nation in how we've cooperated and collaborated to make this law work. So we're very pleased with the growth, and I'm also very pleased with some of the new developments within the charter school movement that Oregon is on the leading edge of. Let me describe a couple of them. There are large foundations in the country who think that the next trend in the charter school movement, as the charter school movement matures, the next trend is for successful charter school models to replicate themselves in one state or in multiple states and create a centrally managed network of charter schools. The most famous example of this you may have read about is the KIPP Academies. It started in Houston and then went to the Bronx, and now there are about 35 KIPP Academy middle schools running in school districts around the country. That's probably the most famous example of this. We, however, have an example right here in Oregon. I spoke to this committee about it last week. The Arthur Academy Neighborhood Public Schools. I'm a co-founder of this growing network of charter schools. These are K-5 schools. They start out kindergarten through grade 2. They add one grade each year until they are K-5 with 150 students. 25 students per class for those 6 grades. Occasionally we go to K-8 if the facility allows. We use a curriculum developed out of the University of Oregon, which is the most research-validated, research-proven basic skills curriculum ever devised, and it's based right here at University of Oregon. It's called Direct Instruction. It uses a phonics-based approach to teaching reading, and it uses a traditionally sequenced math curriculum that is very, very successful. The first Arthur Academy started in David Douglas 3 years ago. It's now in its fourth year with kindergarten through grades 3. The students who have completed 2 years in this school, their average percentile score on the Stanford Achievement Test is in the 94th percentile, the average. So that means our average reader reads better than 94% of the rest of the nation's students.
these results we're hoping to replicate in other communities. So the David Douglas was the first school. This fall, we opened schools in the Woodburn School District and in the Reynolds School District. We hope to open next fall in St. Helens and the Portland School District. And we plan to add two schools each year until we have a centrally managed network of 11 Arthur Academy neighborhood public schools sited in school districts around the Portland metropolitan area. So,
Chair, may I ask a quick question?
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. The students in David Douglas, can you tell us what proportion of the students in the Arthur Academy are minorities?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't have that number offhand. I can certainly get that for you. And I can say this, though. Our student populations are generally reflective of the districts in which we lie. I do know in our Woodburn School, we're exactly reflective of the school district with about 65% students with Hispanic surnames.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we're really excited about what we see as kind of a new governance model for public schools, when a nonprofit corporation can manage essentially as a at-large school district in the state of Oregon and essentially creating a brand name for a public school, where parents might say, wow, Arthur Academy, I know what Arthur Academy stands for, a certain type of an educational approach. Our mission at the Arthur Academy is that every single child, regardless of ethnicity, native language, parental income, or learning difference, will become a fluent reader and master the academic and intellectual skills necessary to go to the next level of school. That's our mission. We think it's very, very focused on one thing, academic results, reading being number one. We think reading is job one for a public school, especially in the primary ages, because it's the gateway skill. Without reading, we know what happens if a child never learns to read. And so we are laser-like focused. We have a laser-like focus on reading as the job one of the school. So I hope you'll be hearing more about that as time progresses. And as I said, we expect eventually to have 1,725 students with 11 schools, all situated around the Portland metropolitan area. There's another charter network also growing in Oregon called the Mitch Schools that just got an approval to open its second school in Sherwood. And also there's a Sandridge Academy, which is a public charter school in Lebanon, and it too seeks to start adding sites in the central Willamette Valley. So this notion of the charter network, finding successful models and using the charter school law to replicate these models, is something that I think you'll be hearing more about. A word about the academic performance, this handout that Joni Gillis gave. It's interesting when you look at this data. You know, we don't like to compare charter schools to other types of public schools per se, because we think that the best measure of the success of a school is a pre-test, post-test measure, or a value-added measure, if you will, of the kids in the school. It doesn't matter, really, comparing schools if all you're looking at is a snapshot of academic achievement, because you don't know how successful that school was in raising academic achievement. You don't know where the children started from. We think the best measure, if you can have an annual measure and put it into a gain, an academic gain for each student, and measure the gain. Unless we have an assessment system that allows us to measure the academic value added, we're never really going to be able to answer that question for accountability purposes that we all want to answer, and that is, how is the school doing at raising academic achievement? We need to have a value-added system to do that. In the Arthur Academies, we both give Oregon statewide assessments, but we also give the Stanford Achievement Test every year for every child, so we have that type of a value-added measure. I think it's something that Oregon needs to move forward. The other interesting development, brand new development, I'd like to announce to the committee happened on Monday night in the SIO School District. SIO, a small rural school district of about 650 students, on Monday night approved the concept for the Oregon's first statewide virtual charter school. And it will enroll, they hope, 500 students statewide this fall in K grades K through 9, and eventually grow to grades K through 12, and eventually have as many as 3,200 students in a school model that's been proven now in 8 states around the country, run by an organization called Connections Academy. The school will be called the Oregon Connections Academy. It's very, very exciting, and I think we should congratulate the SIO School District for being very progressive in its thinking and taking the lead in this kind of innovation. I'd like to reiterate some of the testimony and kind of expand upon some of the testimony about the main struggle we see in the charter community, and this is around the question of renewal of a charter contract. Let me kind of put it in very graphic terms. A charter school might have a 3-year contract to start when it first negotiates its contract. When that contract comes around to renewal, a school district can simply decline to renew the charter. And the charter school has no recourse. It cannot appeal the decision to not renew a contract. And so a school district that wants to get rid of a charter school for whatever reason, even if that charter school has excellent academic results, has parents on a wait list, is complying with the terms of its contract and complying with all regulations and all state and federal statute, if a school district wants it to disappear, all it has to do is let the contract expire and decide not to renew it. And it doesn't need cause to not renew it. Now, I cannot imagine that it was legislative intent to allow charter schools to disappear from the landscape simply because a school district didn't want it around with no cause. I cannot imagine that was the case, especially given the public investment we make and the investment of energy of people, public dollars and energy, to get a charter school going. Now, what charter schools are literally forced to do to deal with this problem, the ones that can look ahead, when their contract is going to be expiring, say at the end of 2005, and if they don't think that the district is going to renew them for whatever reason, the charter school will submit a brand new proposal in September that year, prior year, and then force the school district to go through a hearings process and considering a new proposal for a school that's already operating. The reason, because if the school district denies the new proposal, there is an appeal of a denial of a new proposal to the state, and then they can kick it to the State Department of Education for the process of an appeal. Now, that's an awful lot of extra work, and I think it's a flaw in the design of our law. And we have a very good illustration of precisely this happening right now with the Sandridge Academy, which is in the Lebanon School District. This is a school that has 224 students, and it has 180 students on a waiting list. It's got, I think, a free cash balance of an excess of $100,000, which is more than 10% of its operating budget. It's financially successful, and its academic results have been very, very successful. I don't have chapter and verse in the percentage of kids meeting state standards, but I believe it's in the 90s, if not 100% meeting state standards at the tested levels. It's a K-12 charter school. So by any measure, you can imagine a very, very successful charter school. It thinks, however, the management of the charter school is not confident that the Lebanon School District is going to renew its charter when it expires this July. And so in September, it did present to the district another charter proposal. It's the only defense that it has. And now that proposal is in the machinery or in the works to be considered. So that's the kind of, I think we need as a body to take care of that kind of glaring flaw in our charter school statute. And I think you're going to find agreement from all the stakeholders, school board, association, Department of Education, that we can come up to a solution for that flaw, because we don't believe that it was legislative intent that it's structured that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that role there, have there been any cases where a charter school has not been renewed?
Madam Chair, Representative March, yes, there have, actually, and it was in Eugene with the PICO Academy, the Pioneer Youth Institute, and the Eugene School District declined to renew that contract.
And the outcome?
The school no longer exists in Eugene. They were forced to move to a different district.
Thank you.
Another quick question.
Didn't Sandridge Academy go through that same process when they were tied to the Central Lynn School District and have their charter vacated for little or no reason?
Representative Chair Flores, Representative Dellum, at that point, we didn't have the charter school law. They were a private alternative school at that point. And so, with an alternative school.
They were school-sponsored, and the
school district-sponsored, yeah, or the contract is with the school district. And that's a year-to-year contract, so they simply declined to renew that contract, and that's when they moved to the Lebanon School District with their contract.
Representative Mr. Kramer, I have a question regarding PICO, because I remember there were a number of issues that surrounded the closure of that school, and I think there were some complaints, there were some concerns about the safety of the facilities. I don't think the Eugene School District just refused the charter because they didn't want PICO in existence. Could you elaborate on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I'd prefer actually not to. I was not in the middle of that negotiation and that process, so I think I'd be speaking without enough knowledge. Now, there does happen to be in the audience today board member from Lebanon, Rick Alexander, and if there's time and the committee has a desire, perhaps you could hear from him on this, but leave that entirely up to you, and I would be more than happy to answer any further questions.
Well, if you'd like to share your remaining 2 minutes, we'd love to hear from you.
I'd be happy to.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Rick Alexander. I'm a member of the Lebanon School Board. I do not represent the Lebanon School Board. I am representing my own personal views and opinions. One of the things that we've failed to overlook today is that we put a challenge forward to the charter schools. One is that we do not fund their buildings. We do not fund their transportation. So that puts them at a terrible disadvantage to educate with the amount of funding that they get. So what happens is that they, through the system, have qualified teachers that want to work there, that work at a lesser wage because they do it for the children. One of the other problems that they've got is that being a member of the school board, they are in direct competition with public schools. Now, when our funding becomes available, or remember that Lebanon School Board gets for funding, we, as a board, look at the funding. I look at a charter school as a public school. The remainder of our school board does not. So what happens is that when they ask for their charter to be renewed, it is money that is taken from the Lebanon Public School District and given to another identity. Now that is the way it's looked at. So what happens is you have a competing interest for the funding. So with our school is like the rest, I am afraid that our school board will not want to renew their charter. And so what they have gone and done has been just like Rob has said. So I think that from the ground where I work at, they do it for approximately half of our total budget per student. So what we have to do is we have to make it more palatable for them to be able to succeed. They do it because they're smaller, they have more parental participation, the parents feel better about it. So I would think that in the interest of the students, competition is good. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Any questions for Mr. I appreciate your comments, and I just would challenge you to go out and convince your board members.
I'm trying.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you all. There is no other business to come before the committee. We will stand adjourned. Good Friday.